The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show. Oh, it's you again, huh? Well, I guess you're a real glutton for punishment, am I right? When will you ever learn? And now here's the host you hate to love, the man who was the reason your friend sponsored your last intervention, Eric Metaxas.
Oh, hello. Folks, this is the Eric Metaxas Show. And as you know, I love history. I've written a number of biographies, three rather large biographies, and a number of volumes of shorter biographies, Seven Men, Seven Women. I love the stories of lives, and I particularly love American history. But I'll bet you that many of you have never heard of the following president of the United States, Chester A. Arthur. There are many people listening right now saying Chester Arthur was president of the United States. Yeah, and I don't mean like in some quirky way, like he was technically the president while somebody was sick or in a coma. No, no, no. He was the president of the United States. We're going to hear all about him from the man who's written his biography. The book is titled Chester A. Arthur, The Accidental President. And his biographer, John Pafford, is on the line. John Pafford, welcome to this program, and congratulations on this book.
Well, thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.
Well, I love history, and I was so excited. I thought, who writes a biography of Chester A. Arthur? Chester A. Arthur is like a punchline. He's the guy nobody's ever heard of. He was president of the United States. So I have to ask you, what led you? I know that you're an ordained clergyman, you're a professor, you've been a professor for a long time, but what led you to write a biography of the quote-unquote the accidental president, as you call him?
I have a deep love for American history, and I also have the thrill of discovery, which was provided by Chester Arthur. There is not really a deep need for somebody such as myself to write another biography, let's say, on George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or Theodore Roosevelt or Ronald Reagan. And so I started looking into the lesser-known presidents and found a number of them really deserved to be lesser-known. There wasn't anything that admirable or that interesting about them.
Like Rutherford B. Hayes, for example?
They had a degree of prominence just by virtue of being president. But I didn't find a number of them, again, really that intriguing to me.
Is this mostly?
I didn't want to get into a deeper study. Some I did find very much worth knowing. So, for example, somewhat better known than Arthur was Grover Cleveland, on whom I did a biography. And then Chester Arthur I looked into more and found that really there was a great deal worth knowing about Arthur, that he was a man who grew and showed development in character as he grew older. And so the more I studied about Arthur, the more intriguing I found him to be.
Well, I love that. There are many other presidents. I think of Rutherford B. Hayes, for example. I don't know anything about Rutherford B. Hayes. It seems that the Gilded Age, as it is called, the latter part of the 19th century in America, produced a lot of unremarkable chief executives. But you're telling us that even though Chester Arthur kind of stumbled into the office of president, and you're going to tell us how that happened, nonetheless, he grew in the job and is worth knowing about.
Very much so. He came out of a machine background. He did get off to a promising start in his early years. His father was a clergyman, and Arthur started his studies at Union College in upstate New York. He entered Union College at the age of 15, graduated in 3 years, Phi Beta Kappa. As you well know, the individuals who went to college in the 19th century started at an earlier age. We did have still people who grew to be, or who lived to have a long life, but young people grew up faster in the 19th century. And so he graduated from Union at the age of 18, did study for the law, became an attorney, and entered into law and politics in New York. Now, just to summarize it very quickly, he became part of the Republican machine in New York State and was a machine politician, frankly.
Now, what does that mean?
He wasn't personally corrupt in that he received bribes himself, but he did support the Republican machine. People who worked under him were required to pay into the machine.
Now, what do you mean by that? I'm not quite clear. I mean, some of us have an idea of what that is, political machine. We know it's a bad thing. We think of, you know, back rooms, cigar smoke. But when you say the political machine in the 19th century, you know, I think of Boss Tweed in New York City. But what did it mean to be part of the, I mean, I guess the main idea is corruption. You're saying he was part of a corrupt system.
Yeah, well, the system, yes, I think it's fair to say that there was corruption in the system, no question about that. And you just mentioned Boss Tweed, who was responsible for the control of New York City by the Democrats. There was a Republican machine, too, Thurlow Weed earlier in the 1850s, and then his lieutenant, Edwin Morgan, who became governor of New York. And Arthur started as a part of that machine. Then later, Roscoe Conkling had control of the machine, and Arthur was an upper-level lieutenant in the Roscoe Conkling machine. Now, again, the Republican machine, yes, did favors for people. If you worked for the government, you were expected to pay money into the Republican Party if you're part of the Conkling organization, or into the Democratic Party if you're part of the Tweed organization. There are very strong, clean government elements in those years. But in New York, the two machines really were dominant, and the clean government faction is running behind during the 1870s into the 1880s.
Well, you've written a lot of books on a lot of people. You wrote a book on Russell Kirk, in many ways the founder of the modern conservative movement. You wrote a book on John Jay, and you wrote a book on Grover Cleveland, as you mentioned. The newest one, of course, brand new book by Chester Arthur, and I'll bet you that nobody listening knows anything about him. At least I don't think I knew anything except when he was president. So tell us, how did this guy end up sort of accidentally, as you put it in the title, becoming the president of the United States?
Right, and accidentally in the sense that that's the way it certainly looked to people studying politics. I do believe in the providence of God, and so in a deeper sense, we don't have accidents in life. But as far as the organizations were concerned, there was no intention that Chester Arthur would be president. He was put on the ticket in 1880 to carry the state of New York. The Republicans needed New York in order to win the election. And
well, now, wait, who was he up to that point? In other words, why was he put on the ticket? Who was he?
Okay, yes. All right, to back up a bit. During the Civil War, he had served in the New York National Guard as the Quartermaster General. He had the rank of Brigadier General, and he was responsible for the organization of the New York National Guard. He didn't have a combat post, but he had a very responsible organizational position. And then in 1871, he was appointed by President Grant. Technically, this is a federal position. He was the collector of the Port of New York. That doesn't sound very exciting, very dramatic, very romantic, but it was a very significant position in that 75% of American trade duties were collected
by
the Port of New York.
Okay, hang on.
Over 1,000 people.
Hang on, John Pafford, because we're going to go to a break here. Folks, we're talking about Chester A. Arthur, the accidental president. Don't go away. Hey there, folks. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. We like history on this program, and today we are learning about a president of the United States that most of you have probably not heard of, Chester A. Arthur. This is the latter part of the 19th century. The new book about him is called Chester A. Arthur, The Accidental President by John Pafford. John Pafford is on the line. John Pafford, you just told us that President Ulysses Grant in 1871 makes Pafford the customs collector of the Port of New York. So you said this was a hugely important position.
It was, very definitely. He was technically appointed by Grant because it is officially a federal position. In actuality, the machine in New York would tell the president whom they wanted. So he was definitely part of the machine. And so about 75% of American trade duties were collected by the Port of New York. Over 1,000 people were employed there. So it was a very important patronage position and a very well-paid one. The members of the people who worked for the Port of New York were expected to pay between 2 and 5% of their salary into the Republican Party.
Oh.
But Arthur himself was not personally corrupt in that you could bribe him, but he was part of this, what I would call, corrupt organization.
Right.
And so he's definitely a machine politician, an upper-level machine politician, very significant as part of the Conkling organization. Then in 1880, when the Republicans were going to be struggling to keep the presidency. By the way, the Republicans did control the presidency from the election of Abraham Lincoln in 1860 until Woodrow Wilson was elected as a Democrat in 1912. During all those years, only Grover Cleveland was a Democrat Party president, and Grover Cleveland actually was responsible for having the Democratic Party be a little bit more conservative than the Republicans.
I mean,
during those years,
weren't the
it's a long time of Republican domination. Well, in 1880, the party is concerned about carrying the state of New York, and so the nominee of the Republican Party, James Garfield, who had won a bitterly contested primary, needed the votes from the state of New York. Garfield is a reform politician, an honest man determined to clean up government. But in order to be president, he needs New York. In order to have New York, he's got to placate the Conkling machine. So one of the top members of the machine did not want to run for vice president that year, and it was given as an opportunity to Chester Arthur. So he went on the ticket as a vice presidential nominee. He's still a machine politician, and he and Garfield did not get along well at all. But the ticket won, then Garfield was assassinated.
Okay, what year? What year was that?
Okay, the election was in 1880, and Garfield was shot in June of 1881.
All right.
And then died in September 1881.
Wow, let me ask you a question before we go on. This is an astounding thing because most people, you know, they know that JFK was killed. They know that Lincoln was killed. But when we think about Garfield and McKinley, it is an astounding thing that this is 15 years after Lincoln is killed. We have another assassination of another U.S. president. And then 20 years after that, McKinley is killed. It's an amazing thing to think that in the course of 35 years, three U.S. presidents were assassinated. We don't often think about that, but it's an astounding time in our history.
It certainly is. And Theodore Roosevelt was shot, but he survived it. So we came close to having another one during that period. Now, this was in 1912 when Roosevelt was out of office and running for another term. But yes, there was violence during those years. No question about that.
Well, so
there was not that much security given to the president. When Garfield was assassinated in 1881, there wasn't that much security for him because there was the conviction that the assassination of Lincoln was an aberration because of Civil War animosity.
Right.
And that this would not happen in this country.
If you don't mind my asking, because I don't know, and I'm sure most of my audience doesn't know, who shot Garfield and why? Who were his enemies?
Well, this was Garfield was shot for no political reason at all. It was an individual who was simply convinced that he had a mental aberration, really, and so he was hoping that he would be able to achieve more prominence, to impress a woman whom he loved.
How'd that work out for him?
It wasn't a deep political motivation at all.
To impress a woman. So this is a little bit like Reagan being shot when Hinckley wanted to impress Jodie Foster, my classmate at Yale. What a bizarre thing.
Whoa, your classmate, that's an interesting story by itself, I imagine.
Well, not much of an interesting story, but she was in my class at Yale, the class of 84.
Okay.
Of course, I'm much younger than that would suggest. Well, anyway, so let me ask you then. So Garfield is shot in June, but he doesn't die till September. I mean, I don't remember having heard this at all. So it sounds like we have a constitutional crisis.
In today's medical conditions, he would have survived. There was one bullet which had penetrated into his body, but it could have been left there, and he would have survived even without the removal of that bullet. The problem was that even though there was knowledge of sanitary necessity in surgical practices, the doctors who treated Garfield did not clean their hands, and infection set in, and he died from that infection.
Okay, but 3 months or 2 months later, I mean, 3 months after he was shot.
It looked for a while as if he were going to survive. He was expected to survive, but the infection set in, and again, from the way the doctors probed with unwashed hands into the wound looking for the bullet, they didn't find the bullet. That was totally unnecessary. Totally unnecessary.
Well, let me ask, who was governing during the time that Garfield is what becomes his deathbed? What happens at that point? Does he continue to govern somehow?
No, not a great deal. He's in a sick bed. He does have some papers which are given to him. There's a little bit of consultation of him, but this is a time of weaker central government, and we weren't engaged in a war at that time, and there wasn't any financial crisis which was besetting the country. It was a quieter time, and so things kind of stood in abeyance. Garfield was definitely, he thought, recovering, and so there was no sense of panic at that time. But then when it became obvious that there was something more seriously wrong with him, it was a relatively short time before he actually died. And during the time that Garfield was laid up, Arthur very studiously avoided asserting himself because the assassin was rejoicing that he had shot Garfield and that now Arthur would be president. Arthur had absolutely no involvement with that, and the Conkling Organization of New York had absolutely nothing to do with the assassination attempt. It was just this deluded individual who had tried to get some positions for himself in government. He had delusions for his own future, and it was totally unnecessary in terms of any desire to have good government. I mean, good grief. Well, unnecessary. Of course, the assassination was unnecessary. We don't have that as a means of changing government. But, again, Arthur kept himself out of trying to assert anything, lest it be regarded as very unseemly. So he wasn't trying to take control, to influence anything. Only when the death actually took place did Arthur step in and quickly asserted himself as the president and quickly impressed others with his capabilities.
So he's not just known for his mutton chop side whiskers, which are really, really impressive, but he ends up actually being a good president. We're going to be right back to hear about the presidency of Chester A. Arthur, the book by John Pafford in front of me here. He's my guest. It's the Eric Metaxas Show.
Get back homeward.
Hey there, folks. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. We're talking about the accidental president, Chester A. Arthur, president of the United States, starting in 1881. And his biographer is on the line with me, John Pafford. So, John Pafford, what happens now? Chester Arthur suddenly finds himself president of the United States. What does he do?
All right. He steps in as president. His old buddies in the New York State machine believe it's gravy train time for them, that Arthur is now the president, and the good government reform people are devastated. Turns out they're both going to be wrong, and Arthur is going to really become almost a man without a party, in the sense that he's going to reject his old machine buddies, and he's not going to be fully trusted by the good government people. But what he stepped in and did is, first of all, undertake the revival of the American Navy. In 1880, the U.S. Navy had sunk to being number 12 in the world, and in some respects it was even worse because a number of the ships we had were too old to be effective on the high seas, and a number of the other vessels we had, a good number of them, were only for protection of internal waterways, coastal defense and internal waterways. And so the American Navy, which had been number two in the world in 1865 at the end of the Civil War, second only to the British, had sunk badly, progressively had sunk. All too often, the American people don't have a strong interest in the armed forces when we're not fighting a war. And so we find ourselves very unprepared when the necessity for our involvement in using armed forces comes up. So he revived the Navy. He's responsible for that. The Naval War College was established during his administration. We undertook the building of new ships, and by the end of the next decade, we're one of the most powerful navies in the world. He also undertook civil service reform, which was a big surprise to both his backers and his opponents.
It's a shock. I mean, you're telling me that he was a big part of the machine, this corrupt machine,
yep.
And that the party that was in power, Garfield, of course, was anti-corruption. What is it about Chester Arthur that now, given the presidency, he decides upon a path of reform?
Now, that we don't know positively. I think it's clear to me that this was a change within him. Now, there are a few historians who are cynical about him and believe that he was doing this for political reasons. I think Arthur truly changed within and became the man he could have been during earlier years. The man he had been to a very significant extent during his early years, and then it ceased to be when he became a successful politician, but a machine politician. So I think this is character development. It's one of the rare times in history when somebody comes into office and proves to be far better than he had been before and far better than people expected. You know, all too often, we can be unpleasantly surprised by the person we've elected or the person who has stepped in. We're unpleasantly surprised too often, and it's great to have a pleasant surprise, somebody who turned out to be far better than we thought.
Well, it is
honest, courageous, it's extraordinary. And strong.
Honest, courageous, and strong. Well, that's pretty good right there. So what happened in the 1880s with regard to theology, science, economics, political philosophy that set the stage, as you put it, for sweeping cultural change?
This is still a time of limited government. It's a time when the sound money people are starting to come back to the fore. We had, during the 19th century, the same fight we have today between those who argue that the more money we have in circulation, the more prosperity for everybody. Let's just increase the money supply, pump out more, print more today, and everyone is going to be better off. That fight was going on in the 19th century as well. Garfield was very much a sound money backer. In 1878, the Bland-Allison Act had been passed by Congress, providing for just $2 to $4 million worth of silver coined each month.
Did you say the Bland-Allison Act?
Frankly, the amount of silver that's being coined, the amount of inflation, and he's definitely a gold standard sound money supporter. So he's very definitely on the side of the majority of the Republicans during these years. There still were some Republicans as well as Democrats who still were caught up in this idea that the more money the government creates, the more money the government spends, the better off everyone is going to be. That's a fallacy which has been proven over and over again, but there still are people who will fall for that one. So he's definitely a sound money man. And he also vetoed some big expending bills. For example, the Rivers and Harbors Act he vetoed in 1882. That was a way for the government to have more pork barrel money flowing into the economy through Rivers and Harbors. He vetoed that.
Well, tell us about the immigration. There was a massive immigration from Asia. And I think, is that what they called the yellow peril?
Yes.
Okay, we're going to go to a break here, but when we come back, I want to hear about this. It's a dark period in our history, the yellow peril, the threat from Asia. And you talk about how Chester Arthur stood against this and was able to moderate Congress's response. Fascinating stuff. We'll be right back, folks. The book is Chester A. Arthur, The Accidental President. Hey folks, Eric Metaxas here. There's something you all need to know about Relief Factor and about Pete and Seth Talbot, the father and son owners. As you know, they're on a real mission to help as many people as possible get out of pain, and they've been a consistent sponsor of the show for several years. In radio, sponsors come and go. They may even stay for a year or so. It sounds like they're doing super, and then they're gone. Well, not so with Relief Factor. Pete and Seth are consistent year after year, and that's because tens of thousands of people are now taking Relief Factor every day for their back and neck pain. I'm one of them. Shoulder pain, knee pain, hip pain. And they are now in less or no pain at all. All these people, it's as simple as that. It works. That's why I've joined Pete and Seth on their mission to help you get out of pain today. And the first step is to order the 3-week quick start pack for $19.95. If you're still skeptical, remember, it's not just me. There are tens of thousands of other nice people who would happily tell you to give it a try. It can be done. It could be at your door in just 2 to 3 days. Go to relieffactor.com. Remember, relieffactor.com. It works. It works.
Just yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone.
We are talking about a United States president named Chester A. Arthur. There's a new biography on him. Many people haven't heard of Chester Arthur, but he comes into being into the presidency at a key time in our history. John Pafford is his biographer. So, John, tell us about the so-called yellow peril. That's a term that many people have forgotten.
Yes, this is the yellow peril refers to Chinese coming into the country at that time. And there was the same problem that would be repeating itself on a good number of occasions in history, both before and, of course, after. And when immigrants will come in and will work for less than those born in this country and stir resentment. The first Chinese coming into this country were people in the hotel and restaurant business. They were skilled artisans. They were merchants. But then after the Civil War, there came the need for low-skilled workers for railroads and farms. And people in the United States turned to China now to get low-skilled labor. That stirred resentment on the part of Americans. There was a bill that was presented to bar any Chinese immigration for 20 years. Arthur was taking a middle ground position on this in that he understood the political pressures of those who are resenting having this low-paid labor coming in. He also understood the principles involved and was not one who was a racist himself. Before the Civil War, he had strongly defended a black woman who was thrown off a public transportation in New York City because of her race. He defended her and won the case, and New York changed. Now, the Chinese, according to the bill which was passed initially in 1882, would be barred for 20 years. There'd be no immigration at all for 20 years, and they would have to additionally have a passport in English countersigned by an American consul official in China. Arthur regarded that as racist. He vetoed it. The veto did stand, but there was then finally a compromise arranged at which lowered the ban to 10 years. You can still argue that maybe Arthur could have held firmer than to approve of a ban now for 10 years, but he saw this as an improvement over what had happened initially. And again, there's not really a racist element in his background. The Republican Party at the time of Arthur is gaining the votes it gets in the South from the blacks. The black vote during these years is overwhelmingly Republican.
People forget that history, that the Democrats were seen as the party of slavery, the party of Jim Crow, and that the Republicans were seen as the party that stood for the blacks, that obviously was the party of Abraham Lincoln. It really is a dramatic thing that we have forgotten the history of the Republican Party and black voters and how dramatically that changed because of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. We just have a few minutes left, so I want to ask you, when did Arthur die and how many terms did he serve? Did he serve two terms or one term?
He just served that one term because he was really, in a sense, a man without a clear backing in the party. Now, Arthur did have significant support, of course. It's not just I who looked to him and admired him. There were those who came to see very definitely that Arthur is a good man, he's a solid man, he's an intelligent man, he's a good president. But there still was the reality that the machine politicians, particularly in New York, saw him as having betrayed them, and the good government people still saw him as a part of the conquering machine. They weren't convinced that he was for real. Theodore Roosevelt, for one, were not convinced that he was for real. Also, too, he had contracted Bright's disease, which was a terminal kidney ailment. He had concealed that from the public, partially to enable him to be more effective as president without people seeing him as a dying man and therefore not to be taken too seriously. And also, too, he did not want sympathy. He didn't want people feeling sorry for him. But his health was not good, and he did die. Well, he went out of office in March 1885 and died in November 1886. So he only lived roughly a year and a half after he left office, a little over a year and a half.
Well, it's just extraordinary. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. Here's a guy, he's a party, I mean, worse than a party politician, he's a machine politician who somehow stumbles upward into the presidency of the United States. And then the great news, as you've just told us, he becomes a good president. He becomes an anti-corruption president, a force for moderation. It's an amazing story, and I have to say it's one of the reasons I've been trying to get you on this program for months. We've kept having to delay, postpone, and I'm just so happy we could get you on the program. We've just got about 45 seconds left. Anything that we have to touch on that we've missed?
No, I think you've said it very well. He was overshadowed by other administrations, which were in office during critical periods such as wars and depressions. And he also was overshadowed a bit by somewhat more colorful personalities than he, such as Theodore Roosevelt, but very definitely a man of substance and someone worth studying. There are these lesser-known people in American history who deserve more.
Well, I have to say, as a biographer myself of people who are often not so well-known, it's one of the joys of life that we get to tell these stories, and we're just so grateful that you, John Pafford, have taken the trouble to give us this Life of Chester Arthur. The subtitle, again, is The Accidental President. Thank you so much for the book and for your time. God bless you.
May the Lord bless you. A pleasure to be with you.
Floating on the breeze. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 1970s.
It's a marshmallow world in the winter when the snow comes to cover the ground. It's time for play. It's a whipped cream day. I wait for it to hold you around. Those are marshmallow clouds being friendly in the arms of the evergreen trees. And the sun is red like a pumpkin head. It's shining so your nose won't freeze.
That is Dean Martin, and I was with his daughter, Dina Martin, recently listening to her sing this song in person. It's so beautiful. Aww. And I have to say that in the Christmas special, the TBN Christmas special, I perform this with Victoria Jackson.
Yeah, one of the highlights, I must
say. She plays the role of Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
I play the role of Dean Martin. And you know what? I look way more like Dean Martin than she looks like Sinatra, I got to say.
Somehow,
you know, she really didn't make an effort.
No.
That's the problem with Victoria. But it's such a we had such a great time. We sang Christmas carols and stuff. If you didn't see the TBN Christmas special, ladies and gentlemen, I promise you, there's just something for everybody in it. If you want to find out more details, go to tbn.org for listings in your area or whatever. But it's just on, like, I don't know, they're playing it like seven times over the holidays. Don't miss it.
Don't.
Alvin, people are still giving to CSI.
Yes.
There is still time to give to CSI.
Yep. Still time.
I want to encourage people. Christian Solidarity International is freeing slaves in the Sudan. What an amazing thing that we have the freedom to use our money and our freedom to free those who have no freedom. They're in slavery. We know that radical Muslims in Africa believe in slavery. Their worldview doesn't say this is bad. They don't believe we're all created in God's image and we're all equal. They think that if you're a Christian, you're unequal. And they have been enslaving people for a number of decades. We have to do what we can to free these people. CSI helps us to do that. It's hard for me even to think about this sometimes.
Yeah. I know. But I'll tell you something, what's really great is that this Christmas season, for $250 or any amount toward that, you are paying to free a human being from slavery. It's an amazing thing. And it's not just that some of these people have been enslaved for 20 years and more. But when they get out of slavery, they still have to get acclimated to life again as a free person. And sometimes the family that they are going back to didn't even know where they were for 5, 10, 20 years.
I mean, can you imagine you found out that somebody's in prison for 20 years and for $250 you could get them out. And you know that they don't belong there, that it's a wrong that's been done to them, a horrible, horrible, horrible wrong. And you say, well, it's not my problem. Folks, this is our problem. And we can all give something. The only question is what? There's some people that can give $1,000 and not feel the pinch at all. It's all tax deductible. There's some people that can give $100. There's some people that can give $40. There's some people that can give very little. But you know what? It doesn't matter what you give. The point is give something. Please, folks, you go to our website, MetaxasTalk.com, and you give anything. It's between you and God. But the point is, if you were enslaved, literally enslaved, wouldn't you want those people who claim to be Christians over there in the West to lift their fingers to do something? Well, this is all teed up for you. You're not having to go over and get involved. All you have to do is either write a check or make a phone call, or you can go to our website, MetaxasTalk.com, and click on the banner. Everybody can give something, and I hope you'll understand that we're all on the hook for this, folks. These people are suffering. We can do something about it. We're obliged to. The reason we have our freedom and what money we have and the things that we have is so that we can help those who can't help themselves. These folks can't do anything. And if you were in their shoes, you know you'd want somebody to do something. Yeah. Do what you can. God bless you and thank you.
If you would like to contact CSI, dial 888-253-3522. That's 888-253-3522.
And have yourself a merry little Christmas.